Lives with Colm Arbuckle on BBC Radio Ulster. And you're very welcome once again to the programme where numbers probably do add up, but no one here is even bothering to count them. Today, it's all about strong, inspirational women. Take Colette, for example. Family reared and left home, but she decides to get another family through the fostering process.
I've always wanted to foster all my life. I've always felt that a lot of people have room for an extra one or two. It is one of the most rewarding things I've ever done.
Brendan's wife is a Helen Mirren lookalike.
Not wishing to be mistaken for Helen's bodyguard rather than her husband, I leaned across, lifted my wife's hand and kissed it. She was so surprised that she spilled half of her glass of wine.
And we share memories of the Clogher Valley Railway.
Blue's whistle, Wagney's flag and the train starts to move off, so there's nothing for my father to do only to nip in behind the train, unhook the second brake and bring the train to a standstill. Keep it in the station until his watch says it's time to go.
Studio guests today are Moya Morris and Mary Query. Both women are very interested in psychology and community work, and both are very much involved in helping individuals and groups to work their way through any issues that they might have. Moya and Mary have many things in common, but how they've arrived at this point in their lives is what we will be exploring between now and 3 o'clock. And ladies, you're both very welcome to the programme. Moya, can I start with you? You were a secretary at St Mary's College here in Belfast, and you decided to take a course in exploring dreams, above all things. What made you interested in dreams?
I did indeed. It was a long time ago, and it was in St Clement's Retreat House on the Antrim Road. And there was a dream workshop, and I thought, I'm going to go to this, because at the time I kept a dream journal. And I was just interested in what dreams can tell you. So off I went, and the dream workshop was given by a Paddy Howell from Limerick. And it was extremely interesting. And as a result of doing the weekend, I was able to ask myself, just before going to sleep, there's a certain situation in my life, I'm not too sure how to progress with it. Would my unconscious please send me a very clear dream so that upon waking I can look at the situation from a different point of view?
Now, I'm very interested in this. Many people would say dreams are just a mishmash of things you've experienced on TV or the radio or real life, and that you can't really direct your dreams. But you believe that you can?
I do believe you can. There's a thing called lucid dreaming. You can, from your conscious mind, ask your unconscious mind to send you a clear dream so that you can make sense of what is happening in your life. And it works.
Well, how do you analyse a dream? If you dream about, people say if you dream about water, or if you dream about rats, or if you dream about certain things, they mean something. Is this what you're talking about?
There is a collective unconsciousness, as you know. There are stylized dreams depending on cultural influence, etc. But the dreamer has the key to the interpretation of the dream. So you'll get to know the different keys, what they mean when you dream them. And generally speaking, if you're asking your unconscious to help you resolve a situation, the dreams that you experience will come in three scenarios. But the theme in each of the three scenarios will be the same message, but delivered differently. Could be delivered as a feeling, could be delivered as something like an image, or it could be delivered by something that you hear. But when you decide that you want to get a better understanding of what you're going through, ask your unconscious, just before you go to sleep at night, please send me a dream that I will remember upon awakening, so that I see this situation from a different point of view. And if you do that, say, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 nights, eventually, Colm, you will get that dream, and it'll be very clear. And the lovely thing is, you do wake up, it's like an aha moment, and you think, I never thought of looking at it like that. And that's where your unconscious is helping you understand in a conscious way.
Well, you see, I'm also interested in knowing, how do you direct your unconscious? Do you just simply think about it and think about it and think about it and that seeps in, or how does it work?
Well, as well as the dream workshop, at the end of that weekend, Paddy Hall said to us, in a few weeks' time, I'm going to be offering a different workshop, and it's called the Enneagram. Ennea meaning Greek for nine, and gram or gramos, something written or drawn. And the Enneagram, if you think of a circle, the Enneagram consists of three centres of intelligence: our head centre, our heart centre, and our gut centre. And as individuals, we have each of these centres residing inside of us. But as individuals, we are inclined to operate from one of these centres more so than the other two. And it's my work with the Enneagram to, first of all, know where you're coming from in relation to these three centres, and then begin to tap into the two centres that you use less frequently.
You actually use this in your work, and I want to explore that very, very soon. But let me bring you in now, Mary. You're a psychologist. Do you understand where Moya's coming from there? Do you understand how it works?
I'm a Gestalt psychotherapist, and I suppose I came to psychology from quite a different route to Moya. My background was in youth work and adult education, and I worked in inner city communities in Belfast, and both in Belfast and Liverpool. And what I noticed was that there were people very bright, intelligent. I worked a lot with women's groups in the Shankill and the Falls, and people were very, very bright, and they weren't progressing. They were coming back to the same level of class year after year. And what I started to make the connection was that, in fact, they had suffered some sort of trauma when they were younger. So that was when I started to train, initially in group work, because I suppose that's where I'm slightly different to Moya, is that I believe that it is vital for people who have experienced trauma to have the support of a group and to have the support of their community.
Let me ask you about your childhood, about your young days. You were very keen on football. You wanted to be a footballer, but you were denied the opportunity at a very young age. You came across basically sexism at a young age.
Yes, and I wouldn't have had that term for it. Colm, you know, I come from a family of four brothers and a sister, six of us in 9 years, so there was a lot of, you know, we had a lot of companionship, and football was up there. And I suppose and it may sound quite strange to younger women now, but I went at primary school, I was 8 or 9, and I went to football practice. I didn't have proper footy boots, I had what would have been called gutties, but I had so much enthusiasm. I was a fast little outside left. That's how I saw myself. Now, I wasn't the best one on the team, but every week I went for, you know, loads of weeks thinking, it'll be my turn to get picked. And the day when I saw two lads who were, where I knew were appalling, they were even worse than me, and I wasn't a fabulous footballer, and they got chosen for the team, and the penny dropped, that I am not going to get chosen because I'm a girl. Do you know, that had never occurred to me that that would happen, and it still shocks me. So I had to wait until I was 27 to get back to playing five-a-side football, and I've still got the cup sitting on my mantelpiece. I got a little cup for it. It's one of my proudest possessions.
And was this a mixed team or an all-girls team?
All-girls team, yeah, all-women team by the time I was 27, yeah.
And are you still interested in football?
Well, my interest in, I suppose, physical activity, for a lot of girls, it closes down around about 12, 13. And it's, you know, because of all the issues around our body image. So now I'm still interested in being physically active, mainly through swimming and cycling.
Education is your big passion. And you worked in Liverpool. What did you actually do in Liverpool when you went to work there?
I worked in a very, very large housing estate where a lot of people had been failed by the education system. And it was actually quite pioneering in its day. It was setting up, rather than deciding on a course and then offering it to a group of people, is bringing together local people and saying and talking to them about their lives and what they were interested in, and building a course around that. I was in England for 6 years. I came back in 81 and started encouraging particularly women to explore women's issues through women's studies. But it was like studying their own lives instead of learning history from a book, to look at history from the point of view of the work that their mothers had done, the work that their grandmothers had done in the mills, how international history fitted in with that. So yes, I did that for 18 years and loved it. Still do a bit of teaching.
Your name, Mary Creary, it's an unusual name. Where did that come from?
We've traced it back. It's Query, Q-U-I-E-R-Y. I have to spell it every day of the week. When you phone for a taxi, when you go anywhere, no one knows how to spell it. It's a Huguenot name. I used to say Huguenot, and it was an English woman who said to me Huguenot was, they were Flemish speakers, and they were persecuted in northern France and put out of northern France. So there was a lot of refugees, which is why I would have a lot of sympathy for asylum seekers and refugees today, is that my family came as refugees through England and through into Ireland. The first kind of record that we have is in 1798, a John Query was arrested on the road to Larne with Jemmy Hope, who people might be familiar with in the 1798 rising. Jemmy Hope got jail in Ireland, whereas my relative got sent to Montserrat, which is in the Caribbean. And he served 25 years there. And as people will be aware, there was quite a large slave population. So he married a slave, an African slave, and bought her freedom. And there are still Queries, to the best of our knowledge, living in Montserrat. So we have a black and white section in the family.
It's very, very interesting when you go back and start discovering who your ancestors were and where you come from. Moya, you've done a similar thing because you've traced your ancestry back even further than Mary has.
I was adopted at 3 years of age. Years and years and years and years ago, I got to visit my natural birth mother's grave up in Derry, stroke Londonderry, paid my respects there. And then last Christmas, I took it upon myself to join ancestry.co.uk. There are other sites available, obviously, to trace my family of origin roots. And doesn't it come to pass that there are two McLaughlin brothers born in 1616, Patrick, and born in 1617, Domhnall Gorm, otherwise known as Blue Donal, because of his clerical attire. The Patrick man became the third parish priest of Clonmany in Donegal, and Donal became the Protestant minister there in Clonmany at the same time. So there we have one coin and two sides of the one coin, and I love the fact, I love it, that these two gentlemen existed way back then. They both died at the ripe old age of 95 in 1711.
It's fascinating stuff, it really is. But I think we'll take a wee pause for music now and catch our breath. And Moya, I'm going to let you pick the first piece of music. What would you like?
This goes back to my disco days. I used to be a DJ in the 70s and 80s. I think this was recorded in 1978 by Village People, and I love it, and it means a great deal to me. YMCA.
You get
the Village People YMCA, the choice of Moya here this afternoon. And that, of course, became the theme for gay people, male and female, all around the world whenever it first came out. And this is what I want to talk to you, both of you, about now. Moya, you were in Santa Monica in 1983. You witnessed a gay pride parade, and that changed your life.
Yes, it did. I was a secretary for St. Joseph's and St. Mary's College way back in the 70s through to the 90s. And the environment there at the time, we didn't really discuss diversity. So I went off to the United States of America in 1983, yes, you're right, and went to the first gay pride march. I knew that I was different in my definitely mid to late teens. But when I went to America and came back in 83, I just knew this is me and you're going to have to deal with this. And as I referred to earlier, the Dream Workshop and then my work with the Enneagram, those were ways of me getting to know me and to be able to accept who I was, to have compassion for myself. There were difficulties there, yes, but I'm glad that I did it. When I was very young, the word gay didn't really, you didn't hear it often. You certainly didn't hear gayness or lesbian or homosexual or, you know, any time it was mentioned, it would, you'd get the message, this is not the way to be.
So did you suppress your feelings then?
I would have suppressed my feelings, yes. And then in the late 1980s, I joined Lesbian Line in Belfast and I became a befriender for 5.5 years, whereby I would go down on Thursday evenings and answer the phone to gay women who were in London or in Northern Ireland or wherever and support them. And this is an important story I remember. I'll take it to my grave. I was answering the phone one Thursday evening, got a call from a young woman standing in a phone box in Piccadilly Circus in London. And we talked for a while. And I used my name, Rose, because I was born Moya Patricia Rose. So I used my name, Rose. And she, at the end of the conversation, said to me, Rose, I'd just like to say thank you for hearing me this evening. You have delayed my taking my own life. And I said to her, would you promise me something? Will you please phone me back next Thursday? And she phoned me back the following Thursday. Now, when I went back to work the following morning, I couldn't talk about it, obviously, but it increased my confidence in myself. And that young person in that phone box gave me more than I give her.
Well, I can see you talking about it now, you're still quite emotional about it. Where does the Enneagrams come in to this?
The Enneagram, which I bring to cross-community groups, cross-cultural groups, and do one-to-one work with, the Enneagram is really all about getting to know yourself. Where are you right now within yourself? How are you relating to yourself? Becoming aware of how you really feel in the moment. When we start to explore where we are, then we begin to realize our friends and our family and our work colleagues, they seem to be coming from a different place. So how can I get into that place with them? And so we learn with the Enneagram, we are either head types, 5, 6, 7, heart types, 2, 3, 4, or gut types, 8, 9, and 1. And their focus of attention is so different. But once I get to know where their focus of attention is, I can become mindful in the moment and non-judgmental so that I can take what you're saying to me on board.
Mari, your life took a different turn in Liverpool. What happened?
Well, I fell in love with a woman, basically. I didn't call myself anything. I went to a good convent school where the word lesbian would never have been used, was never mentioned. And then I came back in 1981 to Belfast And being the small place that it is, you know, word spreads very rapidly. So I did experience at the time being regarded as odd, or people were advised not to go and have coffee with me in case if you stood too close to me, it might be contagious. So there was a lot of stigma at that point.
Did you know you were gay before you went to Liverpool, though?
Well, I always knew I was different, and that's quite common in my experience as a psychotherapist, is that a lot of young people, they don't necessarily think in terms of their sexuality at the age of 9, and I knew I was different to those around me. The issue that I've discovered, and I suppose I spend a lot of time now working as a psychotherapist within the LGB and T community, is that it can be quite isolating. A lot of young people are aware of their difference at the age of 9. Now they're much more likely, through television, radio, Facebook, they're much more likely to have a name for it, and that is quite, that's very positive. There is still a big gap between when the likes of Moya and myself, our young people in this part of the world, become aware of their sexual orientation and when they actually share that with someone. So that can be anything from 9 to 15 to being in their 20s, and that is the period where young people are most vulnerable in terms of isolation. And I suppose, Colm, I feel quite angry sometimes that people talk about the problem that we have. We have quite a high level of suicide in this society. And that people talk about that is that and say, well, I've no idea why a young person would want to take their own life. And at the same time, those people aren't tackling homophobia. They aren't tackling casual comments that are made on the radio, on the television. So people have to take responsibility for the impact that that has.
When you come back from Liverpool, you were still a young woman, and I know things are changing slightly here. At that time, it would have been quite difficult for you to be out, in a sense. Was there a lot of opposition, homophobia, towards you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And no matter what organisation you were in, you were never regarded as the best foot forward. I worked in the first women's centre there was in the north of Ireland. And again, people would say disparaging comments, which they don't do anymore, saying, oh, that's just a load of vile lesbians. And I was one of the vile lesbians, you know. So there was a lot of discrimination. But I suppose the plus side of it is, which probably Moya would be aware of as well, there was a very strong and very solid group of people who offered support. And because we were such a small community in the late 70s, early 80s, there was a kind of comradeship there and a certain solidarity.
Now, I don't know about you ladies, have you ever thought about fostering? I have to say now, I have been thinking about it very seriously this past year or so. My wife sort of encouraged me to sort of give it a serious go. Many families, of course, who foster children, they'll tell you that it's a very worthy and rewarding experience, both for the adults and for the children alike. But when you think about fostering, do you see it as a young person's vocation? Colette McCluskey will tell you that that is not the case at all. Her youngest child is 31, and at a time in her life when most people will be thinking about taking things easy, she is still very much involved in the fostering process.
I've always wanted to foster all my life. I've always felt that a lot of people have room for an extra one or two. I didn't realise it was as complicated as it is, and there was as much work involved. But I do have to say, the benefits outweigh the work. It is one of the most rewarding things I've ever done. I'm passionate about it. I'm passionate about training for foster parents because they do need training. You're dealing with traumatised children. You're dealing with a grief and loss. They've lost parents. And a lot of children who are in foster care don't want to be in foster care. No matter what happened at home, a lot of them still love their parents very much. It's what has happened to them that they don't like. And I've had people come and say to me, oh, I would love to foster, but I couldn't give the children back. Well, the way I look at that is, it is very hard to give a child back their parents. But everybody deserves a second chance. And if a parent can change things at home and make a better life for their children, well, why not? That's the place where they should be if it's good.
Your youngest is now 30.
Yeah.
and at a time of your life when you should be thinking about taking things a wee bit easier.
Yeah.
But you're still fostering.
Yeah.
Why?
I love it, Colm. I just absolutely love it. The rewards that I get from fostering far outweigh the things that I could be doing when I've time.
And do you still have as much energy?
I do, actually. In fact, it keeps you young. 10 years ago, I didn't know all the top people in the charts. I do now. I know all the latest movies. I look at the latest styles. I said, it keeps you young.
Tell me about a typical fostering situation. I mean, how long would you normally keep the children for?
I have children long term, which means until they're 18. In my home, we have accepted that will be forever. It won't be until they're 18. If a child wants to remain in my home after 18, we're happy to have them. When you apply to be a foster parent, there's a great big long assessment done of you. You, your family, your children. When I was assessed, they spoke to my children to see how they felt about us fostering.
And how did they feel about it? You have five children.
Yeah.
And were they younger, quite young, whenever you started fostering?
No. They were all left home. All my children were left home when we started fostering. One of my children thought it was a most wonderful idea. One of my other children felt she was worried. She worried because she had looked at it in depth and she was worried about us going into fostering, whether it would be too stressful or whether we'd make a silly mistake and do something that would get us into trouble. But in general, no, they agreed and they absolutely love the children that live here in this house. They've adopted them as that's their part of their family. They have become godparents to them. They buy their presents at Christmas and birthdays, just like all the other kids.
Well, you're a mature lady. I'll not give your age away, but you're a mature lady.
I'm a mature lady, yeah.
Do you intend to keep fostering?
Yes, I do, yes. There's times when you say to yourself, oh, if I wasn't fostering, I could just hop away for a few days here or there or, you know, on holiday without planning or arranging babysitting or whatever. But for the other part of the year, what would I do?
Would you recommend it?
I would...
For an older person?
Yeah, highly recommend it. Highly recommend it. I think I feel older people have a lot to offer with their experience, with their more patient. As I've become older, I've become much more patient, much more tolerant. I was a very strict mum. I was very much on the structure of the home, meals and time. And I remember making my own children clean their bedrooms every weekend. I wouldn't do that now.
Colette McCluskey. And if you are interested in becoming a foster parent, regardless of what age you are, you should get in touch with your local fostering unit. I'm sure they'd be very glad to hear from you. You're listening to Time of Our Lives on BBC Radio Ulster and BBC Radio Foyle. I'm Colm Arbuckle, and my guests today are Moya Morris and Mari Query. And time now in the programme for some more music. Mari, your choice this time.
I'm a big Sinead O'Connor fan. I've followed her down the years. And this particular track, maybe it's 15, 20 years old, but I still think it's very relevant, particularly in relation to the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States. And this is called Black Boys on Mopeds.
Strange that you should.
Black Boys on Mopeds, the choice of Marie Query here this afternoon. Well, now it's time for a regular reflection piece written and read by one of our listeners. This week, Brendan McGee reveals his unusual relationship with the actress Helen Mirren.
My wife came home from work one day, about 8 years ago, saying that someone had told her that she looked like Helen Mirren. I couldn't see the likeness, so I said she should cut back on the medication. She didn't speak to me for a month. To be fair to my wife, three or four other people suggested a resemblance to Helen, including a woman who had worked on a film set with her. Given that the paparazzi never gathered at Witherspoon's door when we were out, I assumed few others saw the resemblance, until one night we were on the Belfast to Liverpool boat. I was delivering my late mother's car to a friend on Merseyside and felt a bit sad, but not Samaritan's low. The car was the last kind of big item link with my mother. I had been with her when she'd bought it, had sat with her when I often wanted to grab the steering wheel, heard stories of the number of near misses caused by other drivers, and saw various parts of the garage door on the car's body. In truth, the registration mark was more valuable than the car. We were sitting in silence in the restaurant when I noticed the waitress looking very intently at my wife. She was very subdued when she came over to take our order. I went straight over to the guy in charge of the restaurant. He made an obviously discreet sweep past our table and nodded back to the waitress and one of the other diners. When the main course was ready, he served it, and then it dawned on me the waitress had convinced him that my wife was Helen Mirren. There were a few clues that might have suggested otherwise. You would think that Helen would have at least travelled EasyJet back to England, and why was she sitting with a fat, baldy guy who was eating burger and chips? But just in case, I sat more upright, held my stomach in, and smiled at the diner at the far end of the table. Not wishing to be mistaken for Helen's bodyguard rather than her husband, I leaned across, lifted my wife's hand and kissed it. She was so surprised that she spilled half of her glass of wine. I should have kissed the hand that wasn't holding the glass. The main course over, the manager arrived back to take our dessert order. "Thank you, madam, and do you mind if I ask you, my colleague over there," and he pointed to the waitress, "wants to know if you are Helen?" My wife interrupted him before he could say Mirren. The waitress brought our coffee and we finished the meal in silence. We got up from the table. I left a £5 tip. I wanted to go over to the waitress, but my wife dragged me away. I was going to say that, sorry, Helen doesn't do autographs. I could see the Sun story. Helen Mirren is a snobby woman, but her husband is a delightful man.
Brendan McGee with our reflection of this week. Moya, getting a support group together for your community, is it difficult?
Way back in 2008, there was a woman who I'm going to call Jane. And she was, and is to this day, very supportive of our community. And she asked a number of women if they would consider writing a short story about being gay in the 1970s and 1980s, so that Jane could bring all the stories together and really compile a book. And she managed to do that. And we had our official launch in Waterstones in 2013. And the book was very well received in the gay community.
And now, you have a copy of that book with you?
I have a copy of this book with me, yes. It's called Threads.
Would you mind reading me a piece out of the book?
This story is called Leaving Jack, and it's been written by Mary. I remember back to that cold October morning. It's as if I'm the observer, not really believing these memories are mine. I see the little house where I reared my children. I feel a sense of pride knowing that I kept it clean, warm and comfortable for them. Until now, this feeling has been filed away at the back of my mind. I've not allowed myself to say, "Didn't I do well?" as it might just sound boastful to those in our neck of the woods. I provided well for my children, making sure they had food in their stomachs and clothes on their back. I was not so lucky in my own childhood. My children were always so important to me, and my love for them is and always has been unconditional. I never experienced this sort of love when I was young, and now it is reciprocated by my children. They clearly show their love for me. I'm glad now that I stayed in that so-called marriage. I did try to leave my husband Jack 33 times, but I stayed and I suffered because my children needed me. I remember positioning myself in the old armchair beside the fire, too frightened to relax. I listened patiently for the click of the key in the lock, and when that sound finally came, my insides churned with nerves. I prayed that tonight he would just give me a hiding and get it over with. It was easier to endure than the mental torture, which went on for 4 or 5 hours at a time. My children are adults now, and my real life has now begun. Yes, I finally left Jack. I knew a friend of a friend who was a lesbian, and we entered into a relationship, but there was still something missing. My instincts were right. It didn't last long. It was not right for me. It was my first foray into a very different world. Then I was invited to a gay venue one spring night in Belfast. I met a woman who was on the same wavelength as me. At this stage in my life, I feel so blessed to have met a woman who is now my love, my life, and my best friend.
Well read, Moya. Mari, can I talk to you about a particular aspect of the opposition to being gay, and that's their religious opposition? Many people would see it as against their religion. Have you come across this?
As a therapist, I work quite a lot with evangelical Christians who are very committed to their religion and who are not able to come out to their family and to their community, particularly their religious community.
Would you see no conflict there at all between religion and a practicing gay person?
No, not as far as I'm concerned. I presume that Christianity is about love. And I'm not sure that it's so finely defined. But I suppose I'm not religious myself, Colm, but I will support people who come from a religious background to try and find a way where they aren't blaming themselves. And a lot of these Christians are self-harming or have been suicidal. But I can see a change, and I do have the permission. One particular client who comes from a Presbyterian background, and she has gone to the United States, and she is in the first group of out lesbian and gay people who are training to be Presbyterian ministers. So hopefully she will come back to this country and will bring a change with her.
Well, now it's time for our weekly dip into the BBC Radio Archives. This week's selection comes from June 1955. In We Never Lost a Train, people share their memories of one of the most celebrated narrow gauge railways in all Ireland, which ran through the heart of Northern Ireland in the south of County Tyrone from 1887 to 1941, the Clogher Valley Railway.
I remember on one occasion now, we're going down there to Ballygawley on a big, there was a big demonstration down there. And the Kelleton party were going down, and there's a hymn they called Tullivar Hymn. And why, she tried it several times and she couldn't reach the top. So however, the guard come and ordered us out to the engine, got the carriages up onto the top of the hill, and then we all got back in again, right in Ballygawley.
The guards, of course, knew everybody and everybody knew them. Coming home from Belfast, of course, you had to change from the Great Northern to the Clogher Valley. And once you'd be safely in your seat, the guard would come along, and though he knew I lived in Ochre, he'd say, "You're for Ochre." I said, "Yes, I'm for Ochre." And of course, he did that to all the passengers. Right down the train, he spoke to everybody and mentioned their destination, went off again. Only a little while would last until he'd come back, ask the same question all over again. And he did that several times during the journey. And, of course, the tickets had to be very carefully inspected to make sure that you had the ticket for the right place. And he would look at them several times and even take them away to the guards van and have a little private investigation to make sure they were in order. Oh, it was, I'd say, about half size of an alarm clock. And, of course, it was the timekeeper of the Clocker Valley Railway. It couldn't be wrong. The station master, who, of course, while the thin's lying at the station, is in complete charge, he had a watch too, which also kept good time. This day, the guard said to my father, it's time we're moving off now. Father says, no, still a couple of minutes to go. The guard says, no, the watch says, there's the time, and must go off. And blew his whistle and wagged his flag, and the train started to move off. So there was nothing for my father to do only to nip in behind the train, unhook the vacuum brake, and bring the train to a standstill, keep it in the station until his watch says it was time to go.
I stopped one day by one of the drivers, the engine drivers, who produced a paper parcel from among the coal, which he handed me with an air of mystery, and saying that Willie sent you this. When I opened it, there was about half a stone of detonators in it. Well, I guessed what I was to do with those, and on the last day of the last run, as soon as the line was clear after the afternoon train, I distributed them over about 2 miles of track on both sides of the station. The last run was to be the train that was due in the village here after 10 o'clock. And it was a most peculiar run. When it came in, it was already pretty crowded. Apparently, all the staffs at all the stations and as many of their wives and children as could get away had were on board, and most of the business people and clergy from the different towns. At our own town here, another 10 or 12 people got on board. In fact, I think the only genuine passengers on it were a very bewildered group of English soldiers who had just been drafted to Five Mile Town that day. They seemed to find the Irish Railways living quite up to their expectations. Apparently the detonators had been distributed pretty thoroughly up the whole length of the line, because I don't think the diesel went for half a mile anywhere without exploding some. Each station we came to, the staffs and their families climbed aboard too, together with townspeople. It was very crowded. We ultimately got to Five Mile Town, which is the terminus, round about 11:30, I think it was. The diesel was then turned, and we started back. However, before we got out of the station, someone had a brainwave. The act closing the line had stated that it was to be closed in 1941. Someone thought it would be a very good idea to get the better of the government. So the driver was ordered to back in again. We backed in and we sat in the station until 10 minutes past 12. It was then 1942, so the government was defeated and the return journey began.
We never lost a train or selection from the BBC Radio Archives this week. You're listening to Time of Our Lives on BBC Radio Ulster and BBC Radio Foyle. I'm Colm Arbuckle and my guests today are Moya Morris and Murray Query. Ladies, can I ask both of you the same question? You're both ladies of a certain age. You've seen things changing. Have they changed dramatically from you were young girls? And how do you see the future?
Oh, I've seen a lot of change. And probably the most important one has been legislation that protects my rights as a worker, that protects my rights as a consumer. We still have a way to go. And I know that this has been recorded during Gay Pride Week and that there is a big campaign that we would have the same right as anyone else to marriage equality. And given that, you know, we are now surrounded in Europe by countries that have started to celebrate their LGBT communities, I think there's a way to go in terms of that one, Colm.
This term, gay, lesbian, homosexuality, all these different terms, I think they're going to evaporate. And as Murray and I were talking about earlier, there's this new word now, non-binary. I remember way, way back somebody saying to me, Moya, if you think of a football field and the two goalposts either end, 10% of the world's population is in one goalpost and they're exclusively homosexual. And 10% of the globe are the other goalmouth and they are 10% exclusively heterosexual, and the 80% in between, we're all kind of on it. We're understanding each other better than we ever did before. and my love and hope for our younger generation worldwide goes out to them.
Ladies, I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you this afternoon. It's been very inspirational. Hopefully we'll see you all again sometime. We'll finish today with a track from Van Morrison called St. Dominic's Preview. I bought the album when I was in a band in America and at a time when I was on the road and had no fixed abode, as they say. All of my earthly possessions were in the back of an old Ford car, including a state-of-the-art hi-fi system, two big LBJ speakers, a turntable and a very powerful amplifier. And every hotel and motel that I stayed in during the tour, I would set up the gear and blast out St. Dominic's Preview every spare moment I had. Why would I not? You've been listening to Time of Our Lives. I'm Colin Arbuckle and my guests today were Moya Morris and Mari Query. John Toll with Classical Connections will be here after the news. Until the same time next week, bye-bye.
Around about now, your face is red. to 95 FM and 1341 Medium Road.